Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Chip Zion.
Once upon a time,
my guest is Chip Zion. Chip created the role of the Baker in Into the Woods, as well as the roles of Mendel in Falsettos and Mr. Bungie in A New Brain, both by William Finn and James Lapine, and the role of Marvin in Trousers by William Finn. His numerous other Broadway credits include Caroline or Change, Les Miserables, and Grand Hotel, as well as the upcoming Harmony. Like I said, I've been dying to talk to you Actually, now I'm looking back years ago. I don't remember the context. I was talking to Alison Frazier, and I said something about how I was fascinated by the development of Into the Woods. And I, you know, and she said, well, you should talk to Chip. I mean, he knows everything. And then that's just been a constant thread. I mean, James Lapine, I think three times said, I got to email Chip.
Really? Well, I was curious, to hear what everybody else had to say, to see if anything that I remember, you know, I'm older now. So
that's the thing. I waited too long. Everybody says it's, you know, 35 years. They don't remember everything. Detail.
You know, that everything I'm saying jibes with what other people might say, or I have a completely different slant. I thought Paul Ford's book was kind of interesting when I
yes, totally.
I mean, he had some thoughts about it that were really interesting to me. And you know, he was so quiet and gentle sitting at the piano. I had no idea. I love Paul. I had no idea he was thinking so many different things while
yes.
you know, he played us all into the theater with a little theme song for yeah. us. And if you were like, you know, he'd be at the roundabout or 54, you know, Studio 54, and you'd see him sitting up there and he'd play us, you know, Into the Woods, or whatever.
Do you remember your Paul Ford theme, like for rehearsals and stuff?
Well, I think I before Into the Woods, I don't remember anything. After Into the Woods, it became bum 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 bum, or something even more. You know, sometimes a silly version of "No One Is Alone." There's a lot of different.
The jazzy
version.
Yeah,
but you know, I loved him, and parenthetically, because I don't know, you know, I was around for that moment when he suddenly decided he had had it at least temporarily with show business.
Yes, on the People in the Picture, right?
People in the Picture, exactly.
Yeah.
And I was there that day. And
wow.
It was a moment in show business I will yes. never forget.
No, oh my.
Paul Gemignani was just, what's going on? Have you talked to Paul? Have you had any, he just sent me a text, you know, it was that kind of thing, pandemonium.
Well, Paul Gemignani is my, my Moby Dick on this. I mean, he had originally said yes, and then he said he couldn't do it, and I haven't been able to get him to, you know, I thought if I could get James Lapine from a no to a yes, I could get Paul Gemignani, but so far, no luck.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, I was, Lapine's book about, Sunday in the park. Yeah. It was so interesting. And I thought, you know, really sort of, you know, for a book about the theater where we all lie like all the time, his book was like phenomenally honest.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting.
Totally.
Interesting. But he didn't do one about Into the Woods.
No, and since he left me hungry for it, that's why I wanted to do the pod. So yeah. Let's start with, you know, I mean, I know that you were very much in the sort of Lapine repertory at that point in time. I mean, having done March of the Falsettos and then Merrily out at La Jolla. Yeah. And I actually just found out, maybe you don't even know this, Ira Weitzman told me that the actual first collaboration between Bill Finn and Lapine was that James did the graphic design for the In Trousers album.
Yes. No, I knew that.
That blew my mind.
Yeah. No, I did know that. I did know that. Let's see. Is there a question on the
top? Yes.
My relationship to Into the Woods.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, first of all, without Lapine, I have no idea what my career would have been. So, yeah. I had gone to California, and I decided that I wasn't, you know, I was going to try to get a TV series or whatever. And I was staying at Oakwood with sad people. have you ever been to Oakwood out in LA?
Yeah.
In the old days, it was actually kind of fun because it used to be a lot of naked people in hot tubs. And I'm talking late 70s.
Yeah.
And it was kind of really cool. And then it turned into guys who had just been thrown out of the house, you know, who were just, had wives who just kicked them out. Or
for anyone that doesn't know, Chip was talking about the Oakwood apartments in Burbank or Toluca Lake. And it's
Burbank. I was, you know, on Barham, sliding down into, you know, Warner Brothers.
Furnished apartments that people can get by the month or whatever for actors coming to do shows from New York, that kind of thing.
I love it. I used to swim laps out there. And if you depending on which way you turn your head to breathe, you could look out at the lights over the valley.
And gorgeous. It
was beautiful. And one time I did that and I was swimming right next to a duck that was swimming along with me.
Oh, was that the inspiration for Howard the Duck?
I thought that was just one of the finest moments of nature. And I don't know, I loved it. But
it sounds beautiful. What's the depressing part?
Well, the depressing part came when, as it aged, we're talking about Oakwood Apartments still out in California where people stayed when they were working out there. It became literally guys whose wives had kicked them out. And then there were a lot of kids there who whose parents had taken them out there to try to get a TV show or to audition.
Oh, yeah.
At one point I had finished I guess it was a little bit later, but when Falsettos ended on Broadway, Jonathan Kaplan, everybody was at Oakwood. And trying to decide if that's exactly where they wanted to be at that point in their life. It was weird to get weird.
Well, were you married yet at this point?
I was. Susie and I have been together since like 71.
Oh, wow.
Late 71. We've been together longer than anybody I know in showbiz.
Wow.
You know, Susie, my wife danced in the New York City Ballet. That this is a personal life, you know. She danced in the ballet, and then she got injured in the early '80s.
Yeah,
and that's when we had kids, and then she continued to dance, and then she's taught now at the School of American Ballet for 35 years or 40 years.
So you were already a dad at this point, and
in Into the Woods, I was a dad. I had just bought. There was a timing issue, which was that. I was very excited to go to San Diego where we first worked on the show.
Was that your first iteration of Into the Woods, the one at the Old Globe?
Well, actually, yes, it was. Well, actually, what happened was I had done a reading. Well, first, I found out that Merrily wasn't going to come into New York. Lapine had invited me up to his summer house for a barbecue. And for a day in the country, and And as I got out of the car, he said, "Have you talked to your agent?" I said, "About what?" He said, "Oh yeah, we're not going to do Merrily." And the color drained from my body. I was really counting on that. That would have been the first time that Merrily had ever been done since I loved doing it. And but we thought we were coming in, and then we weren't.
Did that color your experience later with Into the Woods, where you were more skeptical of whether this was actually going to go in after San Diego?
Well, at that barbecue with Lapine at his country house, he took me upstairs. He had this was the generation of old K-Pro computers. I don't know, you're way too young to know what that is. But it was what they considered a portable computer, but it weighed over, like, it was like hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
This massive thing with a little 4-inch black and white screen.
Yeah.
And on the screen, Lapine said, "Yeah, I don't want to deal with Merrily, but I'm working on a new show. It's about woods, Into the Woods." And he showed me a scene that was on this little black and white screen that had little little animals and like bugs and little people running around in the snow. And he said, "This is it. I'm doing a show about fairy tales." And I said to him at the time, I said, "Fairy tale? I mean, like, we just did real people in Merrily with really interesting problems and about showbiz and greatest thing I've ever gotten to do. And like, what do you do? You're dealing with little fairy tale characters. Why are you doing that?" So that was my first exposure to it. The next thing that happened is that they did a reading at Playwrights Horizons.
Mm-hmm.
Of pretty much act, I think, I don't remember if it was the whole show, but it certainly was act one,
mm-hmm.
in which I read Cinderella's Prince.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I thought I crushed it. I mean, I really thought like I was just, you know, amazing. And Lapine came up to me afterwards and he said, "What are you doing?" So I said, "What do you mean? I crushed it. I mean, it was great. I got this great response." He said, "No, God, it was not right. It wasn't what I wanted."
Was Agony in the show at that point?
No. But the scenes were there, you know, Agony wasn't. I don't remember that we even saying anything.
The rest of the cast?
I remember that Joanna Gleason was there. And I had known Joanna from a previous show, so that was nice.
What show was that?
I got fired from a show called it was on Broadway with Matthew Broderick a while back, or Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, called It's Only a Play.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, Terrence McNally wrote it.
Yeah.
Somebody got fired. I replaced the person who got fired. Then I got fired. Then I got replaced, and then he got fired, and it ended. David Garrison ended up playing that part, but that's another story.
Yeah.
So Joanna was there. The baker was Ray Gill.
Mm.
Ray Gill is an actor who had been in Merrily and a great guy, and he really looked like a baker. Like a big kind of guy. Did you know him? I mean, I don't know. He was just this wonderful person that was a friend, a close friend. So that was my first exposure to the show.
And anyone else from that cast? Ray?
I can't remember, other than Joanna and Ray. I'm like, who was the other prince for? I can't.
Was Betty Buckley the witch in that version?
No. That's kind of an interesting story too, but that's later.
That was just like a one day table read.
It was like maybe in 86, like even before we had gone to San Diego, it wasn't like a workshop or anything. It was just everybody got together. I think we rehearsed a few hours and then read it.
Mm-hmm.
I told this to James, and he claims that this just completely made up, but he's wrong.
Oh, no. He had all these false ideas. He told me Ellen Foley never played the witch on Broadway. What I'm looking at, you know, playbills with their name on them.
So then I end up, I'm in LA staying at Oakwood, I get a call from Ira Weitzman, who said, like, you know what, Lapine is about to call you. He's has an idea. Stephen and James have an idea that you should play the baker. And I said, you know, really? I mean, he said the problem is they want you to fly back to New York to read for them. And Ira said to me, to his everlasting credit and my gratitude, he said to me, don't do it. He said, they're so up in the air. He said, they wanted Tom Hulce and they can't get him. Because I think he might have been making the movie of Mozart at that time.
Amadeus, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, Amadeus, right. So he said, Lapine is about to call you. Tell him I was shooting. At this point, I was on a TV show that nobody ever saw. It was fun, but
Love
it was,
Sydney. I saw every episode in real life.
No, it wasn't even Love Sydney. It was a show called Shell Game.
No, never saw it.
Starring Margot Kidder. And on the first day, Margot was having some issues at that point in her life. And the producer came up to me and he said, keep your bags packed. This will never, literally on the first day of filming, he said, this will never go. We made 7 episodes. It aired opposite Cosby on television. And it was dead last in the ratings. And that was the end of it. But I didn't know that at the time. I actually was filming Shell Game. So Ira said, tell James that your shooting schedule prohibits you from coming back to New York. You're not able to do it. You'd love to play the part, which is, I said, okay, but you're making me nervous, Ira, because I really would like to play this part.
Yeah.
Did you have a
sense from the reading that this was a great role that you know?
Yes, I had known. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily saw myself because I don't think I look like a baker.
Yeah.
Except of, you know, bagels or I don't know. It's like I don't feel like I don't know that I look like a baker. So and Ray did, and also was a friend. So Lapine called me and I said, you know, James, I can't make it. I was lying. I said, I really would love to do that. That would be unbelievable, but I'm kind of stuck. And he said, oh, God, I don't know what to do. Then he said, we really wanted to see you read some of the scenes. And I hung up and I called Ira and I said, well, I told him. He said, yeah, just sit tight. I'm on it. I'm on it. And a couple of days later, Lapine called and he said, well, it's too late. We can't we can't think of anybody else. So you'll do it. You do it. And that's how I got the part. And so I came back to New York and they were a little, I was maybe a day or two late to the rehearsals. And very quickly he was throwing me out there to do act one and it didn't go so well. And I said, James, I'm off the plane. You know, you're making me nervous. I said, I'm on a TV series. I don't need to do musicals on Broadway. And thinking that the show wasn't as bad as in fact it was, the TV show. Yeah. But Joanna Gleason pulled me away and she said, Chip, let's have lunch. Let's go have lunch. Let's Chip, come with me and let's go have lunch. She pulled me away from potentially what could have been a bit of an argument. And then I think about a day later, Lapine, we did this run through. I'm holding scripts. And, you know, he came up, he said, I had Ray Gill in my mind, but this is great. It's going to be great. And that was, so there we were. And we were rehearsing down in the West Village someplace.
Oh, West Beth?
Yeah, West Beth, exactly. How'd you know that? That's like,
I think Ira Weitzman told me that. Yeah.
Yeah, we were at West Beth, like in this weird place. And, No More hadn't been written yet.
Yeah.
No One's Alone had not been written yet. And one day Sondheim came in. We had, you know, he had checked my keys, the key that I'm comfortable singing in. And, you know, a few days later, he came back with No More. Mm. And we went into the other room. Geminiani grabbed me and Steve was there and we went into this other room with the piano and it's in the old days of like when they tape music together like an accordion and and it's falling out on either side of the piano and it's, you know, and Sondheim sat down at the piano and played for me and Tom Aldrich and Geminiani No More for the first time.
Wow.
And it was, you know, first of all, he's fun. He's playing it and he's singing it. It's always fun to hear composers sing the song.
Yeah.
And I turn around to Geminiani, who's a bear of a guy, just tears streaming down his face. And we were all just a mess. I mean, it was just, I couldn't believe. And I remember thinking, oh my God, it's in my key. This is Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah.
It was an amazing, amazing moment. So eventually, then we go to San Diego. And
yeah.
You want to interrupt me with any question that makes me more coherent than that?
No, that's extremely coherent. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm curious if between having had that positive feedback at last from Lapine, mm-hmm. and then having this incredible song, I mean, whatever wound up happening with Into the Woods after that point, the show could have been a flop and never been heard from again. You already had this just incredible song written for you that just would last time. I mean, did your attitude change in terms of, wow, this is exactly what I want to be doing?
I think we had a sense, I think Joanna and I both had a sense that our lives were changing in some sort of dramatic way. I mean, when we did come back to Broadway, we were rehearsing down at 890 Broadway, and we would share a cab back up to the Upper West Side, and we would go by the Martin Beck, which was where the show was at the time.
Yeah.
And, we would look at the marquee and think, like, this is unbelievable, I mean, this is really unbelievable.
People are always asking me if I'm on Ozempic, and let me tell you, I do not mind them asking me that, but I'm not on Ozempic. They especially ask me that when they see me eating dessert or desserts or all the crap I eat when I'm out. But my secret is that when I'm home, when I'm by myself, I'm eating Factor. Factor sends me restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever I am. No prepping, no cooking, no cleanup except for like my fork. And now you can enjoy Factor Meals too. Go to factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 and use code giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. That's code giantsinthesky50 at factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off.
But we went to, so we get to San Diego.
Yeah.
And, there's a class, I'm sure you've heard the classic story that like people after the first act, they started going home.
Yeah.
And I believe that my sense of that whole thing was that it was Stephen Sondheim and went out into the parking lot and said, there's a second act. I think we had dressing room windows. My memory of it is vague, but people were saying, we were all laughing because people started going home. You could see cars leaving. It was like, great, show's over. And Sondheim said no. And then he added that line in at the end of the first act, which was, what's the line? The
second. To be continued?
To be continued. Like yeah. One of the other things that led into this, I'm all over the map here, but when we set keys, we had to go to Sondheim's house to set keys in his piano and stuff. And there's an interesting thing there, which was that, did you know who this Steve's next door neighbor,
Catherine Hepburn, right?
Was Catherine Hepburn?
Yeah.
Okay. And they weren't fond of each other,
right?
Did you know that? So I had been in fact, well, I don't think I'll say it, that I was in a movie. I had to go to Catherine Hepburn's house to be approved for a film. I was in a film with her.
Oh wow.
Which was very exciting, and I thought it was also going to be a big moment, but it was possibly the only bad film she ever made.
What was that?
Do I have to say the name of it? It's called The Ultimate Solution of Grace Quigley. I rarely say the name. I mean, I remember after we finished shooting it, or it was like the word of mouth was getting out, like the New York Post called me and said, what happened? Like, was it Hepburn's fault? I was just like amazed. I had all these scenes with Catherine Hepburn. And
wow.
I had to be approved by Hepburn. I had to go to her house. And she greeted me at the door, which was amazing. And we walk into her den and she says, what do you drink? What do you drink? Whoops, what happened? What do you drink? Do you drink scotch?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, I don't drink scotch, ever. But I said, yes. And then she came out, she said, this is the glass that Spencer.
Oh, wow. Out of.
And so we went, and then we walked into her backyard, which was an open courtyard that all the brownstones on that block.
Right, Turtle Bay.
Yes, backed up against. There was an historically preserved, beautiful park.
Wow.
That was behind all of those, that block of brownstone. And so I'm standing there with her, and I'm really, it's Hepburn. And she said, you know, there's this guy who lives next to me who writes music. And like, he plays the piano at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he's just, she said, I climbed his rose trellis the other night and pounded on the glass because you can't have people playing the piano at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay, now jump ahead. I'm now in Sondheim's house setting feet for the show. And he said to me, you know who lives next door? And I said, yeah, I happen to have been. I said, it's very weird, but I happen to have been in Katharine Hepburn's house. And he said, yeah. And he said, she was scared the hell out of me. She climbed up the side of my house and pounded on the glass window. And I believe the point of this story is that I kind of believe that there's a sort of a well-known line in Into the Woods, which is it's the witch next door. I'm not 100% positive, but I think that was like an in-joke about how Steve felt about Katharine Hepburn.
That's hysterical.
Yeah, so that's that. Anyway, where are we now? We're in San Diego. So
we're in San Diego, yes. And you're feeling now that you're part of something special, and
yeah, it's like great. And San Diego's kind of fun, and it's and the old globe is very pretty. And
but did you have that haunting you that just a year or two earlier you'd been there, crosstown in La Jolla, doing Merrily, thinking you were going to Broadway, that this was another stalled pre-beat?
You know, the truth is. I didn't. I just assumed that with Stephen Sondheim, I think my brain was saying like, well, this is going to go back to New York. But it was disappointing because what happened is, we finished in San Diego, and I bought and thinking that we're going basically right back to Broadway. And I bought an apartment. I had made money on the TV show, and I had enough money to buy a condo up on the Upper West Side where I lived for 100 years. And so I bought the thing and the apartment, and I got a Saab car. I got a car. I bought a Saab. I had to have a Saab. and then there's an announcement that we're going back into workshop. And we probably wouldn't open for another like maybe 8 months or so.
Yeah.
And that was devastating to me because I felt like, oh my God, I thought I was going to be on salary. I've just taken this giant leap in my life to buy a
business. Yeah.
And I'm supporting my two kids and like, oh my God, I don't want to not do it. So I have to keep myself free to do it. And, then we went through all these things. We auditioned choreographers. Lapine would call us in. We'd audition different choreographers.
Wow.
Lara Lubavitch always referred to me as Chuck.
Chuck.
And I used to say to him, Larry, my name is Chip. Okay. And he was the selected choreographer. Famously, by the way, when the show, when we were actually putting the show on, Lapine one day... in front of the cast, he walked on stage and he said to Lara Lubavitch, I love this whole number is great. I love everything about it, except for the steps. Can we just take out all the steps?
He just liked the traffic patterns and like the timing?
He didn't like the steps.
Yeah.
And I think Lara Lubavitch almost fainted at that point and said like, kind of dance is kind of about steps and movement. Lapine said, yeah, but if we could just kind of get rid of all those steps.
It was the right decision, though, I assume.
I think James is really smart. So I think it was. And maybe it was a little too dancey, you know.
Were the other choreographers that didn't get the job? I mean, did you have people coming in giving you, like, you know, jazz hands and stuff?
Yeah. Well, we had all different styles of choreography. It was actually very weird, kind of fun.
It was in the workshop process.
Well, what happened was that I'm a little foggy. We basically had a workshop to fix. The main thrust of it was in San Diego, Joanna Gleason ate an apple and died.
Right.
Somebody threw an apple on the stage. She had her affair with the prince.
Yeah.
Someone threw an apple out onto the stage. She ate the apple and died.
Yeah.
And was never seen again for the rest of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be not sufficient. I can't remember if we worked with the choreographers first or we had the workshop first, but basically when
you came back from San Diego, the show closed in San Diego in January of 87.
That's right. Right.
And the workshop was in August. Is that right?
You know what? We did all these different versions of Act Two and Joanna's stuff. And I've lost it, but the other part of it was, basically those workshops were mainly to figure out what to do with the baker's wife, that was a little more fleshed out in terms of what her arc was.
But that's when the choreographers were coming in.
I think the choreographers came in maybe before that.
Before that, do you remember any particularly, different ones?
No, I think Lars scared me. I mean, you know, he had a famous modern dance company.
Yeah,
but he was trying to do what? What are the painter with the fat people? The strain of starts with a B. They're round, bulbous.
Oh, yeah, who is that?
And he was saying. Think to us that's the style of that I want you all to get, which is to walk around like to do this.
Oh God!
we're not live. To kind of clump around. And,
yeah.
I remember thinking, oh God, I don't know what this is, but So that we went back in the workshop, and then it became pretty obvious that we would continue. And then,
because that was pretty quickly from workshop to Broadway rehearsals.
Well, yeah, it was about when we closed in San Diego was in January, and then I think back by the time September rolled around, we were back in rehearsals to do the show on Broadway.
And then that workshop was where Betty Buckley was the witch,
right? So. Yeah, this Ellen Foley slugged me on the street at one point because she said, you know, we were pals, and she said, look, I haven't heard what is going on with this show. Like, did you have an offer to do the show? And
prior to the workshop.
Yeah. I can't remember how this all worked out, but it was just before we started rehearsals for the Broadway production.
Wow.
And she hadn't heard anything, and yes, I had. And
yeah,
I was nervous about the whole thing. Whenever there's a break in time,
yeah,
you know, you always think, well, Mandy can do it. I mean, you know,
right?
And Mandy,
and you bought a condo and a sock.
I bought a condo and a sock, and Mandy and I had kids at the same time, and we were pals, and we had. We were having dinner one night, and he was saying that generally, if a show goes out of town, that once it comes into town, they offer him the part. And my wife turned to me and she said, "Wow, that's weird. Weren't you just out of town with this? What are you doing?" And I was negotiating. So then I got nervous at Mandy's house, and I stood up and wandered around, and I looked on his piano. He had the script and score of Into the Woods. And I told the next day, I said to my agent, I said, whatever the deal is, just take the deal. it's like, I'm terrified now, but that made me close my deal a lot sooner than I might.
Wow. That's an interesting way the producers laid pressure on, have Manny Patinkin go to dinner with you.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, where are we? Then we're rehearsing the show. Now it's Betty Buckley.
Yeah.
And that's a whole interesting chapter too, because Betty Buckley would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, she was, but we were all a group already. We had done the show in San Diego.
You know? Yeah.
And so that it got a little tricky, but I just was, Betty Buckley was on the road with Hello Dolly, and I flew out to see her. I loved her.
Me too. I saw her in Miami Beach.
So real and funny, yet funny. And then, the voice, and, she's so great. But somewhere along the line, I was in the country somewhere, and I got a phone call from Jem and Yanni saying that Betty Buckley had been replaced, but that she had been replaced and that Bernadette had agreed to step in. She would have been fantastic.
I mean, it's also weird to me, like, all the legend around Bernadette's casting in the role. I mean, I've heard stories, she was at lunch with Sondheim, or they called her begging or something like that. But it seems so odd to me that after Sunday in the Park with George, I mean, if Mandy had the music on his piano when you were having dinner, how is it that, like, it had never occurred to anybody to even think about Bernadette? And the closest,
it may have been that Bernadette didn't feel, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can speculate that Bernadette, in looking at the show as we had done it in San Diego, thought maybe the part wasn't
right.
All that she would want it to be.
Right, that Joanna was playing the lead and that this was a sort of secondary role.
Right, and songs like Boom Crunch, which was, stuff that were complicated and I don't know.
But wouldn't she know? Reading that amazing book by Lapine about Sunday in the Park, and Bernadette having lived through it, knew that at the 11th hour they gave her Children in Art, and Mandy got vice versa, lesson number 9, and that they were gonna get it, make it happen, right?
Yeah, well, and she did agree to do it. Bernadette is just, she's so loved. She's everything that we all think that she is. She's just the lovely person, and she's really fun to be around. And I think they just were, and they love her, Lapine and Sondheim. And I think they just felt it took some pressure off of them.
Yeah.
In a way that made them more comfortable and not have to worry about stuff. But they did also, they at some point, Lapine came up to me and he said, we're going to have to add stuff in for Bernadette.
Yeah.
We're going to have to kind of move some things around. And he said, I think you're going to probably lose some things that you probably really like. And one of which was my favorite scene in the entire show, which I did lose, which was that after I rescue Little Red Riding Hood from the wolf.
Yeah.
I have a scene with Joanna where we're sitting there and we're saying, well, what the hell do we do now? She's, where's that kid going to go? And Joanna says, well, I think we'll have to take her in. I mean, like, what else could we do? And I say, no, I can't stand her. I say, I hate her. I don't want her anywhere near the kitchen. Okay. And it was the best laughs. Like, I felt some of my best laughs in the show. I just wasn't having it at all. I didn't want any part of her. And I said to Lapine, I said, no, cut anything. I love that. This is one of my favorite scenes. He said, I know, but it's just where it is in the show. And and the other thing about Boom Crunch was that, has everybody talked about that number?
Well, I know it was the song that preceded, before Last Midnight was written. Right. That was the witch's song after It's Your Fault. And that it was, Paul Ford was talking about how much he loved that song. But I mean, I've listened to a few versions of it now. It doesn't sound as good as Last Midnight to me.
Well, I agree with Paul. I thought Boom Crunch was a really good song, and I think this is another thing, but I'm probably totally wrong. Bernadette was struggling with it because she hadn't been rehearsing that long.
Yeah.
And
was it late in the process when
she came in after we had been rehearsing to go to Broadway, so she missed a couple of weeks. I mean, you know,
wow.
And Boom Crunch is a really hard song. And then there's a complicated orchestration, and the blocking was a little nutty and
it, yeah.
You know, difficult. At some point, James and Lapine, James and Steve decided to, I think they had made up their minds that they were going to replace the song.
Yeah.
And so they missed a couple shows. This is in previews. They missed a couple shows. And I thought one night, I thought Bernadette sang that song, Boom Crunch.
Yeah.
It was a massive success. I mean, it was like the audience went crazy. And I said, like, gosh, I wish the guys had been here because I don't know if they've ever seen that. It was like this amazing response. And it was brilliant. And but it was like gone the next day when they came in with Last Midnight.
Well, speaking of the songs that came and went, one that I've now heard a lot about is Second Midnight, the long version of Second Midnight.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
I don't, you know what, I can't remember. I always hear about that, and I barely remember any, you know. I mean, the big thing musically that happened when we were in San Diego, was that No One Is Alone came.
Yes.
We opened the show without No One Is Alone.
Right.
And I know that Lapine has talked about having too many ballads in a row.
Right, because it's No More, No One Is Alone, Children Will Listen.
Right, right. But, you know, when No One Is Alone came in, you know, that was an amazing experience too. I mean, you know, yeah, the sort of transitional First Midnight, said, you know, Second Midnight gone, whatever. Those things all changed. And I, for the life of me, you know, I can't remember how all that went.
Sure.
Down.
But I mean, the Second Midnight, it was, I guess, the version that now, like, I mean, I've heard several different incarnations, but they were all over 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
And they had, do you know that melody from Children Will Listen that people use as a verse in Children Will Listen? I think Sondheim put it in for Barbra Streisand, and now it's sort of part of the like pop version.
Yeah.
But that was in that, and you sang it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you can put that in your act, Chip.
We'll do that. We'll do that at the green room.
Yes. I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, I don't remember. You know, it's weird.
Yeah, and then Bernadette came in, I guess they wrote Last Midnight, they made little changes, the show is coming together. I mean, do you remember it being did you feel rocky during the preview period, or did you have this underlying sense of these
the
guys?
The previews were tricky. I remember the previews being kind of tricky because things were changing still.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was complicated and I think I still thought that nothing could stop it because, you know, the people involved. But that might have been a bit naive. And I know that, you know, I think James got pretty, you know, at one point he said something to me about, like, you know, you can't believe the pressure I'm under, you know, from the producers and to cut them again. Maybe he said, but they, you know, they want more Bernadette. They want to see the audience is nervous because they're worried about Bernadette.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, she left the show rather early.
Right, because I think maybe that was part of why, hopefully I'll get to talk to her, because I know she had movies that she had already...
Yeah, I don't know what that was exactly all about, but when it happened, James called me, and he was upset with me about some scene. He was giving me notes, but I said, you know, James... I said, why are we? And he said, all right. He said, Bernadette is leaving. I said, like, oh, well, you're kidding. First of all, I thought like it was amazing that she was leaving.
She had only been open for a few months. And
yeah, I mean, it was like, she was leaving. It was like March or something.
Tony nominations could even come out.
We had left in November. You know, we had opened in November and you know, and she, and it was like, and she decided to leave.
Yeah, November.
And I think all of us were concerned that, you know, it wasn't as though we, you know, we weren't the calling card in terms of ticket sales and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think everybody was concerned. And he was concerned.
Yeah.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And I don't know. I never also have never talked to Bernadette about what exactly went into that calculation. But, you know, I didn't want her to leave.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
We had a thing where when she came, when the witch came into the house at the beginning of the show, where there's a thing where she stomps on a bug.
Yeah.
It's on the floor.
Eats it, right?
Yeah, and eats it. The thing was, I never knew when she was going to do that. She used to look at me kind of sideways, like look at me like that. And then she's, this is in the show, you know, then
yeah.
She'd down at the ground and then she'd pause and not deal with it. And so I never exactly knew on any given night when that was going to happen. And the other thing that Bernadette did was that, well, a lot of things, but she was friendly with Tony Bennett. And I'm a huge Tony Bennett fan.
Wow.
She's very close with Tony, as she called him. And one night I thought I'd had a bad show and I stomped up to my dressing room. And you know, I stormed past the doorman and like climbed the steps to my dressing room and shut the door. And I was so upset with myself. And Bob Westenberg was my neighbor up there. He was in the room next to me. And I hear a knock on my door and I hear somebody say, "Hey, it's Tony." And I thought like it was Westenberg saying that he was going to kill me for acting like a jerk. You know, he was going to like hit put out on me or something. And I'm in my underwear, I take the door, yank it open, and I say, "Tony fucking who?" And it's Tony with his daughter. And for a while there, I became known as Chip Tony fucking Who Zion. And I don't know. But, you know, Bernadette was just a tremendous amount of fun.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it. None of us would have wanted her to leave.
Well, it must have at least been a relief that the first replacement was a big TV star and that, you know, the show wouldn't shutter.
Yeah. And then, and Felicia Rashad sold an amazing amount of the ticket sales zoomed, but I think the Tony nominations helped because we at some point there we got like 12 nominations and you know, it was thrilling and you know, we gathered some momentum.
In the fall, when you were in rehearsals and previews and when you first opened, were you aware of the sort of hype machine around Phantom of the Opera? Was that part of your sort of purview experience?
I don't think at the time that I took it as seriously as I should have.
Yeah.
I mean, it's inconceivable to me that it's still running. I mean, like, you know, I mean, like, I mean, you know, we opened at the same time.
Right. Like, it's the third Broadway revival, the 10th like, New York production of Into
exactly.
the Water.
I mean, that a show opened and ran like that forever. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. I also, the other thing about George Lee Andrews, I thought of our generation was going to be the greatest leading man that we had.
Yeah.
George Lee Andrews. And he, you know, 25 years, he made a choice and raised his family and did all this, you know, for that length of time. And, you know, I knew so many people that were in and out of it. But
speaking of George Lee Andrews, I have a question that no one has known the answer to that maybe you will.
There
are demo tracks, these like, sort of cleaned up demo tracks. Some of them were re-released on the remastered Into the Woods CD and others have been on a Sondheim box set. And they're George Lee Andrews, Maureen Moore, John Cameron Mitchell, and Kim Crosby, and Betsy Joslin singing early. There's the Boom Crunch, the Second Midnight.
Really? You know what? I send those to me.
I will. I absolutely will.
I don't remember ever hearing that. What were they? When were they made?
Nobody knows. Ira Weitzman was floating theories to me. Maybe they were done later. No, they couldn't have been done. I mean,
I don't think so. I think they had to have been done earlier.
Of course, yeah. I mean, and
You know, George Leanders was the lead in the first national company of Little Night Music.
Oh yes, and I saw him play the role in the City Opera broadcast of it. Yeah.
He had a relationship with Steve. So but I think it had to have been done. I really honestly don't know.
Yeah.
You know, when we recorded the record in New York,
yeah,
or Into the Woods, there was a lot of press there. And Steve said to me, he said, "This is why I have a problem with actors." I said, "What is what?" He said, they're all talking about me. They don't know me. He said, "You know, they're all making up stories about me." And I said, I made the mistake of saying, "Well, Steve, I'm going to be totally cool. Don't worry about a thing." And I said to him, I said, because I just told the reporters, I said that no one knows that Stephen Sondheim is a 6 handicapped golfer. And he looked at me and said, "What the hell are you talking about? That's not funny. I don't even know what that is. I don't know what you're talking about." And that's something I've regretted all my life. I thought it was a smart ass remark.
Yeah.
I should not have said it, you know. But when I recorded No More,
yeah,
and on New Year's Eve of 87, going into 88,
yeah,
I got a call at about 6 o'clock at night saying, "Chip, it's Steve. You got to fix the last note on No More." I said, "Whoa, what are you talking about?" He said, "It's not right. It's a little flat, and it's got to be fixed." And I said, "Well, you know, they had already gathered like millions of people at Times Square. It was late. It was like 6 o'clock at night, you know." And I went. He said, "You got to get down here. Just get down here. We're going to re-record the last note." And I went down there, and when I walked in, he said, "Oh no, it's fine. We just grabbed another take. It's all good. It's all good." But, you know, I was not going to not go to fix the last note, you know. But
well, it's the important thing is that we have that beautiful album. So Bernadette, you said, left maybe sometime in March. And then you had already left, though, and then came back to do the video. No,
I never left.
Never left.
I think the only cast, I was just thinking about that this morning. I think I'm the only person who never left. I had a little bit of a nibble on Robbins Broadway. Jerry Robbins had come to chat with me about it.
Oh yeah.
But I didn't, I was nervous to leave Into the Woods. I had two kids in the new apartment.
Yeah.
I needed the money.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think, what else am I going to, what could be better than what I'm doing? So yeah. where am I going to go? And the television thing got complicated because I didn't miss out on, you know, there's this thing where you fly to California and do network tests and
yeah.
you have to, it's always a huge nerve wracking experience. But I sort of was too late. You know, I got to that point, but I said, you know, I don't feel comfortable leaving here, and I, you know, and so I you know, I stayed the whole run.
2 years.
Yeah.
And so you did it with all the replacement witches and
Baker everybody. Wives. I did it with everybody. And I was a little upset because in the summer, late in the summer before we closed of the you know, the
1989.
Right. I had taken my my vacation. And I found out while I was on vacation that the show was going to close. And I was mad at myself for having left for those 2 weeks. When everybody came back, it was a sensational experience. It became like a, you know, we had to kind of readjust and kind of get back to the way we had originally
done
the show. But each performance that we taped 3 nights in a row. If other people talked about it, we taped three nights in a row. And it was like a giant rock concert. I mean, it was, you know, it's I'm so stuck. You know, the reaction that Into the Woods is getting here now,
yeah,
you know, is so thrilling. I mean, people are carrying on, and you know, the closest we came to that was those three tape performances where everybody was practically trying to sing along, and was every number stopped the show.
Yeah. And
after that show, I had a really bad, weird superstition that I would turn the light off in my dressing room. Have you heard this story?
No.
And I would never turn the light off in my dressing room until I left to go home at the end of the evening. Dumb, because it's not good for the environment, but right. now I don't do that. But at the time, I would turn it on when I arrived, and I would turn it off dramatically when I was done for the evening. And after the third taping, I walked up to my dressing room and the light was off. And I thought, like, you know, I don't know, I don't buy into all that stuff, but I thought, like, that's kind of weird. Who would have turned my light off? We've been doing this for a couple of years. Nobody's ever turned my light off. And I walk in the room and turn the light on. Sondheim is sitting in my dressing room, tears rolling.
In the dark. Screaming.
Yeah, dark, in the dark. And he's saying, "Chip, greatest night of our lives. It's the greatest night of our lives." And it was the, you know, that was my special moment with Steve. I mean, it was like, he said, "I thought you'd understand." And it was amazing.
That's so impressive. I mean, it's so interesting to hear this perspective on the video, because there have been so many, you know, high wattage Sondheim events. Of course, the 80th birthday where you and Joanna sang It Takes Two. And it, for people watching, I mean, I grew up watching that video of Into the Woods, and it has that energy. And I sort of never understood why, because one would think that it was just any night in the run, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was really special. And it's so great that it got, I've always thought somehow the second act on camera, the way James, and I forget who else directed, or there was somebody else.
He did. I mean, that's the other thing. Compared to Sunday in the Park, where they had a television director do the cameras, James directed the cameras.
Yeah. So there's something about the intimacy of those shots that capture a lot, and I'm very pleased, obviously, that we did it, and proud that I thought the second act really looked great.
Yeah,
you know, I was thrilled by that.
I mean, it's really, I don't think we can appreciate how much impact that has had on making Into the Woods the kind of landmark, iconic show, you know, that it is. I mean, just. I'm 46 years old, and I think I'm probably near the top age bracket that had that. And everyone younger, I mean, that's like the Bible. That's the gateway drug to musical theater, I think, and certainly to Sondheim.
It's such an amazing thing. I mean, you know, you don't, when you're worried about your part and you're creating the show and you're rehearsing and going home and every day and thinking like, oh God, I got to be better than that. Or I got to fix, I didn't get a laugh there, and what can I do? And, you know, you're worried. You're also so horribly focused on your own performance. I've been accused of that anyway before, but you know, the scope of it, geometrically expanded, I think, based on that tape.
Yeah.
And the life that it's had has been so thrilling. And I don't know that we really, I certainly didn't think in those terms at the time. I mean, I was proud of it, but the life.
Do you remember the first time that you saw that tape?
Yeah. Yeah. Bob Westenberg called me and he said, we all got copies. You know, in those days, I mean, like, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, like, social media and what was available to see that might have been photographed that you could see on YouTube or something.
Yeah.
So we're going like, wow, that, you know, that was kind of beautiful, you know, and it's like, glad I was in it. Yeah. You know, that feeling.
Had you ever gone and seen a performance with the understudy on, or had you seen the show at all?
I never saw, my understudy was Phil Hoffman. I never saw him do it. I never sat out. And so the only thing I could see that I knew about the audience was that my younger daughter would always get carried out in act two. She couldn't take it. She was terrified of the witch and that dad was going to get hurt.
Oh.
I could see from the stage, I could see the door at the back of the theater open because you could see the light coming from outside. And I knew it was my wife and daughter leaving before it got too scary.
But so that tape was the first time you saw Into the
Woods. That was the first time I really had a sense of what the show might look. I guess we must have shot some sort of commercial, but it was really that tape that gave me a sense of the show. I don't remember having seen that before.
Well, I mean, it is so perfect. I mean, it's when I feel with Into the Woods, they can make the movie, they can make any revivals, they could do it in any incarnation, modernize it, do anything. It doesn't matter because we have it preserved and as, you know, ideal a light of the original intention.
My daughter was at an all girls camp and one of the, you know, they invited me up to, you know, be at a rehearsal. And that production, which was all young girls, was the first production I saw where they had like a storybook and the people were coming out of the storybook. And I actually thought that was one of the most imaginative productions that I'd seen. I enjoyed it so much. And, but yeah, it's done so many different ways. I mean, like, and I think the version that's being done now, the concert version, I mean, I loved it. And I felt oddly, I felt like, wow, that's a good show.
Yeah.
I thought they were wonderful to see. And I love the fact that that beautiful orchestra was behind them and so obvious, so visible.
Yeah.
The scenes themselves were center stage.
Yeah.
You know, and so the pristine quality of the scenes were so, it was very intimate in that way.
Yeah.
Right there, center stage always, you know, not that much movement. And I found myself, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
I also really enjoyed the version that you did in Central Park where you played the narrator and the mysterious man.
No, that, that's, there's some issues. Lapine had some issues with that.
Oh, because they took liberties with the script to
he took a meeting one day. I got really scared because I thought, like, I knew he had some, he was texting me saying, what's going on? Anyway, he came to the previews and he was upset about a couple things. One was that he said, I've never seen a production at the Delacorte where nobody comes in the VOMs, you know,
through the house.
They're not using the space. He said that, and he said in that huge multi-level thing is like so far upstage. He said, what's going on? Why did they do that? But eventually when we were in previews, he came in one, we got a message that we had to come to the theater a little bit early because James wanted to talk to the cast. And he said, he came in to say, he gave a note to the cast and, you know, it was directed by Brits, but you know, and Lapine came in and he said, like, he said, it seems to me that it works a little better and it's not quite so naturalistic and it goes a little faster. You know, and that was a big note, and he had feelings about it, but I loved being in that production, and you know, Jesse Mueller and Sarah Stiles people were just unbelievable, I'm blanking one of the actresses' names. She was wearing, it was 110 degrees. I'd never played the Delacorte before or after. And we were running around on mulch that was wet.
Yeah.
Mulch on the stage. Raccoons came up and stole the fake bread, which was what I felt terrible about. They stole the plastic bread that, you know, in the baker's kitchen.
Yeah.
And I felt, but then I heard a fight, but we could hear the raccoons fighting underneath the stage. And they were fighting over plastic bread.
Poor thing.
And, but, you know, I really also had a good time at that production, too. Donna Murphy, you know, it's Donna Murphy playing.
Yeah, sure. And Gideon Glick and Christine.
Gideon was so much fun. So, well,
that must have been such a sort of seminal experience to come back to the show and sing the other half of No More. I mean,
I loved it. I have to say, it was Amy Adams, you know,
it's
amazing. They, the, 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 uh, all the women in the cast followed me home one night. I didn't. They decided we were going to have a party in my apartment. And, I was doing this stupid thing where, you know, well, it doesn't matter. They all decided to lag behind, but suddenly all of them show up in my apartment. And, you know, it was great fun. And they got up here and I had no food, nothing. I had nothing. They opened the refrigerator. So you're pathetic. This is pathetic. Susie was, my wife was teaching, was setting a ballet in Kansas or something. And we just, you know, I've been eating out every night. I was, yeah. Like, you know, and, no, that was a good group too. They were fun.
Would you ever want to go back and do that again? Like possibly in the Broadway production or a different one?
I think I never realized how many times Tom Aldrich had to change his clothes. and like what an unbelievably difficult that part was. We did a 10-year concert of it.
Right.
And I remember sitting there with Tom, who I just love.
Yeah.
Great. Just great guy. And he was saying, he said, you know what? He said, I'm going to say it. I think I'm going to die right now. he said, I think I'm too old. I can't. This is killing me. I can't do it. I'm exhausted. And he said, I don't even have to change my clothes. You know, I never appreciated until I did his thing in the park, changing clothes. I mean, it was insane.
So. Yeah. Well, so that wasn't really an answer.
Oh, what was the question?
Would you ever be open to stepping back into that?
I think I don't think I want to do it anymore. Yeah. Because I'm afraid of, I don't know. I don't think so because, you know, in a funny way, I was upset when they did it to the Delacorte. I couldn't be the baker again.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was too old for that. And, I think Joanna Gleason said, you've changed.
You're thriving. You're different in the woods.
You're old. You're older. We're too old to play these parts.
No.
And, you know, so I don't think so. Harmony is my next gig. And then, I'm trying to keep my fingers crossed that happens as they're saying it will happen.
Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of energy behind that now. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, Chip, this is just, I mean, so incredible to talk to you. I really can't tell you how grateful I am.
Can you piece something together about what we've said?
Are you kidding? This is I barely have to edit anything. This is absolutely wonderful. Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Check out episode 3, where I chat with Danielle Ferlin, the original Little Red Riding Hood.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.